Imagine this, your phone rings in the middle of the night. You answer it through the fog of sleep and you learn that a loved one's in the emergency room. Two terrifying phone calls like that are the starting point for Seattle writer Domingo Martinez's new memoir. It's called My Heart is a Drunken Compass. Domingo Martinez sat down with Ross Reynolds.
You're in a very bad place for much of this new memoir, My Heart is a Drunken Compass. And towards the end of the book, a friend says to you, you need to write your way out of it. And when I read that line, I was wondering what you were, tell us what you were thinking when she said that was maybe your way out.
Despair. It was just this flood of absolute despair, because I had tried previously to publish and I knew what sort of David and Goliath situation that was for me to penetrate the publishing world. And I had no idea how to do it. I didn't know the first steps. Everything that I knew about it, I'd basically learned from movies, and that obviously wasn't working out. And so when I was told, the only way out of the situation I was in was to write my way out of it or to publish, which was code for publishing, I just thought, that's it. You know, I might as well give up now because there's no way this is going to happen.
And yet, with some blind faith, you jumped into it.
Yeah, it was more of a stupor. I had nothing else, and so I just decided, just to take the next step and the next step. And the real magic in this instance was, instead of trying to publish like the whole book at once, I broke it up into pieces. And the instructions I had from my friend, whose name's Sarah, was to polish up my five best pieces, my five best chapters. And so I thought, oh, okay. And it was basically the whole Anne Lamott thing about, bird by bird, instead of trying to do the whole thing at once, break it down into individual things that, don't eat the elephant all at once. You got to eat the tail first type of thing. And I did that without even realizing what I was doing. And it was the right thing to do in the moment of absolute befuddlement and darkness. I had nothing else going on except to do that one thing. And so I did it, and slowly, it just started to turn into an actual, career event.
It changed your life and it changed your career, but did it also kind of help assuage the pain that you were going through?
It did. I kept thinking of it. Every time I'd score one more particular publishing event, I thought of it more as an apology from the universe for what I had been going through the year or two previously. And as they started to sort of culminate and turn into this, an actual transition in career this late in my life, going from a graphic designer to an actual published author with a body of work. At first, it was obviously unbelievable. In fact, I was thinking on the way over here that if I had known what I'd was getting into, my naivety really helped me, because had I known what I was getting into, I would have been terrified and I probably wouldn't have taken those steps. But as things have gone on, reading in front of crowds of hundreds, the National Book Awards, meetings with Salma Hayek, etc., it tends to leave you a little thankful, grateful, and terrified.
Well, one of those calls in the middle of the night is about your younger brother who's collapsed in a dead drunk, cracking his head on the curb. He's ended up in intensive care. And that part of the book, maybe hopefully most of us have not experienced that, but it's a story that anyone with younger brothers can kind of relate to, the way that younger brothers admire and follow their older brothers. And sometimes older brothers have bad habits, and sometimes it leads those younger brothers into a bad place. You describe a lot of those conflicting emotions one has about one's brothers when that happens.
Correct. The distance that had grown between particularly me, because I'd lived in Seattle and my family was still in Texas, but just emotionally also, because my little brother just sort of found himself in this complete miasma of a life when he was finally allowed to. He set free and went to school and he started hanging around the wrong kids, or sometimes even the right kids, the drugs were just prevalent there, and it was a completely different culture than what I was accustomed to and what any one of us were accustomed to. And my little brother Derek just sort of dissolved, his whole personality just kind of disappeared into that muck. And so I, having been raised Mexican Catholic, I sort of really took it on myself thinking that it was me. You know, obviously it has to be me, you know, or my other brother, you know, that we didn't do enough as older brothers. We provided the wrong, ideals and we weren't we weren't there for him.
He saw us drinking and he thought it was correct. Cool, and then he started to do it, but he couldn't kind of get out of it.
That's right. Yeah. It was the whole idea that we were responsible for triggering the alcoholism and the addiction genes in him by swanning about and pretending that we were like extraordinarily cool and look at how tough we are, you know, in the how many beers we can drink at night, et cetera, et cetera. And that was, of course, the first thing that I thought of when, you know, when I heard of that particular that instance when he had his accident. We call it an accident, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, alcoholism and substance abuse has a big effect on the men in your family. And you all have what you call a peasant stamina for drinking and kind of a pride in it at a certain point. This is our thing.
There's that sort of duality in that where it's like, God, this is terrible, but we can take more of it than anybody else. You know? and that was sort of an ideal that, you know, I grew up with. And quite frankly, that resonates very much for my grandmother, who was very much of the old world. I think more new world because of the whole Columbus thing. But but she, this is a person whose generation was, she was, poverty-stricken on a Mexican farm in the Great Depression, and she just prided herself entirely on being able to take three times as much as anybody else, and she could do more than anyone else, and she completely inflicted that sort of sensibility in myself, my older brother Dan, especially my dad, and my dad wanted that also, but it was never the strongest among us.
Type of thing. Yeah. Now you've got a section in the book about drinking with your father.
Yeah.
Maybe you could read that for us now.
Sure.
I'm speaking to Domingo Martinez, and he's talking about his new memoir, "My Heart Is a Drunken Compass," which tells the story of his life that kind of ends with the story of his first book, which was a giant success, The Boy Kings of Texas. It was a New York Times bestseller. And it does go back to Texas, where he comes from, but a lot of it's set here in Seattle. And this is a section about you and your dad.
Through their 20s and 30s, my father's neighbors and cousins drank with no sense of mortality or health or consequences, destroying kidney and family both while sharing their bewilderment over breakfast ponies, wondering why a wife had packed up the kids and vacated, or why they felt so depleted and weak so often. It wasn't denial. It was a deep, sincere cultural inability to understand the direct connection between alcoholism and their ongoing health and psychological issues. Beer, simply put, was the answer to all of life's problems. How could it ever be the source? Their commitment and faith in alcohol was as absolute and religious as the Peruvian tribes have in the cocoa leaf. It's mana, it's relief, it's life-sustaining and ego-enhancing, though admittedly, for some reason, it can also be a bit illegal. And if it was so much good, how on earth could it be at all bad? Once, I remember watching a conversation between my father and one of his older cousins, Raul Medrano. Raul was a small, rail-thin man with dark, nearly red skin, made much more amber by his flushed face and his body's instant insulin reaction to alcohol as the first and sometimes only thing he put down his throat every morning. "Mira, primo," he claimed in exasperation and alarm as he spat out a dry, cottony spume, seemingly devoid of any moisture. "Mira?" He'd eaten nothing for days and lived on Budweiser while he worked with Dad, but he'd become so broken down from alcoholism, his body had bloomed in huge, painful boils, and the minute he'd have his first beer, his liver would protest violently, and he'd turn a hot crimson color with all the arteries in his neck and his face dilating. He looked tortured that morning as he stood swaying in the glaring primordial South Texas sun, standing there looking bewildered and uncertain as to what was happening to him, and no one had the presence of mind to say, "Jesus Christ, man, drink a glass of water and get some help with your drinking." Instead, Dad would volunteer to drive him home, and Raul would smile around a huge lump in his cheek that should not have been there, and say, no, that's fine, I can walk. And I'd watch as he stumbled down the dirt road towards his house a couple of miles away in that blazing heat, and wonder at their inability to make the connection between the beer and the level of disease. He died in his mid-40s, left a widow and two boys with nothing but hospital bills, and that would have been my father's fate as well, if my father had not left him.
Domingo Martinez reading a section from his new memoir, "My Heart Is a Drunken Compass." Thanks for stopping by.
Thank you for having me.
Domingo Martinez with Ross Reynolds.